is Pierre. As always, a presentation of the Myers Automotive Group. Good morning, Pierre. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. There are a lot of permutations. Good morning, yeah. JR. Hey, Sean.
Morning, Pierre.
I know you talked to Hammer off the air, and he tried to explain what Bob McKenzie was tweeting out last night. So in a nutshell, Pierre, it's the eight play-in round losers would go into the draft lottery, and the draft lottery would play itself out as it normally does, where if you're the, you know, the 15th team, you still have a shot at getting the number one overall pick. The interesting concept is that they would have the draft lottery before the play-in round, which would be in July. The draft lottery would be in June. And they'd essentially have a second, if one of the eight teams that lost in the first round actually got the top pick, they would actually have a second lottery to determine, you know, which team is associated with which pick, if you know what I mean. So
I totally know what you mean. So let's just use Pittsburgh, Montreal.
Yeah.
If the Carey Price factor kicks in and Montreal upsets Pittsburgh, even though Montreal has the worst record, Pittsburgh could potentially, if they were to lose, potentially be a lottery team and win the lottery, potentially.
Yes, but Minnesota owns Pittsburgh's pick, so
in a nutshell, that's what it would be. So
yes.
Minnesota eventually would get that, exactly.
What do you think?
Well, nothing's perfect, as Commissioner Bettman and Deputy Commissioner Daly have said. It's probably the best way to appeal to everybody so you can get everybody kind of singing from the same songbook. But I will stress, nothing's perfect in this world right now, especially in the hockey world. They're just trying to get things done. And if you can curry favor with everybody enough so that people are prepared to accept your decision, then it works.
In the case of Pittsburgh, Pierre, and on the other side, say the five spot, though, because I'm trying to you think of each market. If you're basically, I've earned the five spot in my conference, if you're going to have a play-in where I'm all of a sudden turfed after two games, I guess their argument would be I should be eligible for the draft lottery, right? I mean, I'm the one that worked all season to be in the five spot. Now I'm on the outside looking in to possibly team number 24.
But I think that's where the subtle art of negotiation kicks in. I agree with you 100%, and that's probably one of the things they had to do to compromise to get this to actually even have any kind of legs at all. But it does make sense what you just said. It totally makes sense.
Yeah, and for Ottawa Senator fans, we need to reiterate, the draft lottery odds for Ottawa would remain the same. So the bottom seven teams, your draft lottery odds stay the same. So this would be like a typical draft lottery where, I think you need to stress that. I kind of like it, Pierre. I'll be honest with you.
Me too.
That's idea of a second lottery where if one of the numbers comes up and actually wins the draft, the whole idea of you not knowing exactly who gets the number one pick until after the teams have lost in the play-in round, that's, I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I find that intriguing. And everything, listen, there's no bad ideas, right? We're throwing everything against the wall.
Right now you have to. You know, everybody's really anxious and excited because they do see, you know, some light at the end of the tunnel in terms of being able to come back and play. Again, I don't know if they are or they're not, because everything's fluid day to day. I mean, everything is so darn fluid. So one day it looks good and the next day it doesn't look as good. But when you start hearing them talking about the draft and the draft lottery and things like that, that's all part of the normal sequencing of an NHL season. And it's something they're going to have to get to at some point. And I think if we get to that, then potentially we can get back to playing hockey too.
Pierre, in the NBA, I believe the players are paid year round, are they not? Versus the National Hockey League. Do you think that gives the league more leverage versus most of the NHL players that have basically gotten their entire pay?
Well, that's what we've talked about for the last three or four weeks, actually. You know, I brought it up to you guys. Basically, the fans don't need to know this, but players, their last pay period ended April 5th. That's when they're done. So they don't get paid in the playoffs. They get bonuses based on how they do, but they don't get paid in the playoffs. It's a little bit more difficult. And you saw two teams, Tampa and Carolina, who said they didn't want to be part of this. And both of them will be part of it if we come back and play. So, again, it's very interesting to see how it plays out. The one thing I think all the players are going to have to wrap their head around, though, Sean, is getting back into game shape. They've been out 2 months. And that's not easy to do. It's just, as you know, from being around it as long as you've been around it, it's one thing to have a summer off where you know you're coming back in September for training camp, so you have a finite date when you have to prepare for. These guys have been out for 2 months with no end in sight, and so it changes your training unbelievably.
Devin Dubnyk, the Minnesota Wild player representative, was also on that call and Minnesota did vote in favor of it. But he said, look, this is just setting the format. There's a lot of road racetrack in front of us before we're back to playing hockey, which you have said and said many times is the same. He's talking about, you know what, if we're going to be in the hotel, are we in the hotel the whole time? Do I have to eat in my room? Like, is there a chance that just based on health and safety protocols, that the two sides may not be able to come to an agreement and get hockey back on board just because the players either consider it unsafe or the league pushes too hard on one side? Like, is it possible it could go that far?
That's what I'm saying. There's just a lot of permutations in this whole thing right now. Absolutely. And Devin's not wrong in terms of what hotel are you staying in? Where do you have your team meals? How many other people are going to be exposed to the hotel that you stay in? What are going to be the activities? Are you going to be boarded up for 2.5 to 3 months in one hotel? Are you going to stay in the same pod? I was told at the beginning that once you go in the pod, you can't leave the pod until you're eliminated. That's significant. What happens if I know everybody says, Sean had the good point a long time ago about, you know, guys used to go to war. Totally agree. Different kind of animal, but I totally agree. Things are different. You know, things are different. If you're a UFA, I'll throw this out at you. If you're a UFA that's had a pretty good season and all of a sudden you've had 2 months where you've done nothing, how anxious are you to really want to come back and play? I don't know if you are. So there's a lot that goes into this decision-making, a lot of stuff.
Devin Dubnyk, and again, I'm respectful to anybody, 34 years old, has made $29 million in his career on a $26 million six-year deal, only has $2.5 million left, Pierre. How he sees this, and he's basically financially whole, if he even walked away from the rest of his money, and this is going to be the problem, right? And this is the problem with the Players Association. Everybody's going to view this completely different depending where they're at financially.
That's what I was just saying about the UFAs. Totally agree with you, 100%. If Alex Pietrangelo signs his contract right around when Roman Josi signs his contract, he's fine. Going forward, he's going to be in good shape. He doesn't have a contract. And there are 24 other players that are pretty substantial names around the league that are potential UFAs that don't have contracts for next year. How are they going to look at it? And they're high profile. A lot of them are high profile players. So this is a lot going on here. It's not just that easy to say, oh yeah, we're coming back. We're doing this, this, and this. It's not so fast. It's going to take some time.
Former Dallas Stars coach Jim Montgomery spoke for the first time yesterday, Pierre, to Pierre LeBrun of TSN and The Athletic since his firing back in December, said his dismissal was, to use his words, justified, and said, to paraphrase his words, it was the right, it's actually been a good thing for me. Admitted to the fact that he is battling alcoholism, believes he's on the right side of things now and headed in the right direction, and hopes to coach again in the National Hockey League someday. Do you think that's possible, that he'll be able to get back in the NHL?
I do. Everybody deserves a second chance, and he's definitely going about it the right way. I love the quotes that he had about Jimmy Neal. Anybody that knows Jimmy, and he coached, or didn't coach, but he worked in Ottawa right at the beginning when the franchise was getting off the ground. And there's not many more honorable people in the National Hockey League than Jimmy Neal. And the way Jim Montgomery talked about Jim Neal and the way they dealt with the whole entire situation, I think, is just a good example of Jim Montgomery crossing over and realizing that there was a lot that was wrong and he needed help. And Jim Neal's one of the guys that helped him get help. I've known Jimmy Montgomery a long time. Tried to recruit him out of Pembroke, where he played for the Lumber Kings, to come play at St. Lawrence before he went to the University of Maine. So I've known him for a long time, got a lot of respect for him, and what he's going through now is probably going to help some people long-term, not just himself, but going to help people long-term, and I do think he deserves a second chance, and eventually I think he'll get one.
Had a few nights in Montreal with him and Jimmy Rivnak, a super, super guy. When you look at this scenario, are you respectful of the fact that, and again, maybe the super insiders, but the fact that Jim Neal, generally people will start this process up here where they say, I can't tell you what happened, then it starts to slowly leak out. I mean, Jimmy Neal has been very respectful of Jimmy Montgomery's privacy in this, and it's pretty amazing.
I can just tell you, from my situation, when I got diagnosed with prostate cancer, Jimmy had it, and Jimmy was one of the first people to call me. Lou Nanny and Jimmy and Glenn Sather were people that were on the phone to me right away just to try to help and explain the whole situation, what you're going to go through, the trials and the tribulations. And Jimmy's been phenomenal, just been phenomenal. So I can't say enough good things about Jimmy Neal. And what happens when people go through job searches, usually the people are talking about hiring you, they'll call the people that used to work for to see if there are any red flags. And I'm sure Jim Nill will be very, very honest, very, very open, and very, very honorable when dealing with Jimmy Montgomery.
Speaking of coaches, Alain Vigneault is going to join us in the show next hour, has the Philadelphia Flyers in fourth place in the Eastern Conference, which, well, gets them, they're not in the play-in round, so they know they're going to be in the so-called playoffs if hockey does return. How would you assess the job he's done with Philadelphia in his first year?
A+. He's been fantastic. He's done a really good job. He's extremely popular with the training staff there, with the players. He's delegated really well to Mike Yeo and to Michel Therrien. Their bench, I've done a lot of their games. Their bench is calm, cool, and collected. He's really done a good job, I think. Made players better internally, especially Ivan Provorov has really gone to another level. I think that's been very, very important for them. And you can just see the confidence that Travis Sanheim has that maybe he didn't have a year ago. I think that Alain has done a tremendous job, one of the better coaching jobs in the league this year. I really mean that. And again, I've had the luxury of doing a fair number of their games, and I think he's been excellent.
Some head coaches in the NHL are insecure, won't hire former head coaches. Do you like the fact and the experience he has between Michel Therrien, Mike Yeo, and certainly with Mr. LaPerriere?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, Ian's down there. He's a holdover, but Alain would have known him from the Quebec Major Junior League, obviously, when Ian was a tremendous player in Drummondville, and Alain was coaching in Hull Gatineau. But, no, it's a really good staff. It's a fun staff to be around. You know, I think you'd have to ask Alain, but I think he and Michel Therrien live near one another down in Florida, so I think they've spent some time together. And Yeo and Therrien were really big friends in Pittsburgh going back to when they were in Wilkes-Barre together. So there's a lot of tie-ins there with that entire staff. There's a sense of familiarity that I think really worked for all of them.
23 years ago today, Alain Vigneault was hired by the Montreal Canadiens to be their head coach, which I'm sure, and we'll ask him about this, being a French-Canadian kid to be hired to coach the Habs must be one of the most thrilling days of your life. But and you would have watched him, Pierre, coach through his entire career throughout the National Hockey League. Has he changed at all in his demeanor behind the bench, or is he essentially still the same guy?
No, he's changed significantly in a good way. And all young coaches evolve, especially if they do the debrief after they get fired the first time. What I really respect about Alain is after he got fired in Montreal, he went back and coached in Quebec, in the Quebec Major Junior League. Then he went and coached in the American Hockey League with the Manitoba Moose. And so he really had some bumps in the road, and he figured it out, and he did a magnificent job with Rick Bowness out in Vancouver, a really, really good job. But when he first got that job in Montreal, people have to remember this. He was a disciple of the late, great Pat Burns. And that's what Montreal was hoping they were hiring. And they were hoping he would be the next Pat Burns. And he really could have been. The problem was the team wasn't particularly good. They didn't have a number one center. They were trying to figure it out in goal. You know, they're just coming off the Patrick Roy trade, which wasn't nearly good enough for them. So there were a lot of issues there. He did not inherit a very, very good situation there. And then they had an upper management change, and that's when it kind of fell apart for him.
And to that change, was that some of his best work in Vancouver? Because I know when Mike Gillis took over, there were lots of thoughts that he wouldn't last, but he transitioned in, and boy, did a great job there and almost won a Stanley Cup.
One of the things that I think really helped Alain was he got away from the trap-it-up defensive posture type of game, and they opened it up in Vancouver. And I think that was one of the edicts from Mike Gillis saying, okay, you can coach here, but you can't coach the way you used to coach. I'm paraphrasing now, but I would say something along those lines. And boy, Vancouver became a very, very difficult team to play against because structurally they were really well built. Athletically, he turned them loose, and they could play a robust, nasty style, or they could play a slick, fast style. Whatever, you know, you chose to try to present to them, they could handle it. And I thought, again, some of his best work was in Vancouver, no question.
All right, Pierre, I want to put you in a happy place. I want to take you back to this very day, May 26th, 1992. You're an assistant coach with the Pittsburgh Penguins. It's game one of the Stanley Cup Final, and listen closely. This happens. And, of course, Mario would go on to score the game-winning goal in the final minute. Game one, yeah. Pittsburgh 5, Chicago 4. I think anybody that has probably seen that clip a million times of a very young Jaromir Jagr absolutely undressing a couple of Chicago Blackhawks. Take us through being on the bench when that goal is scored.
Well, first of all, they were playing a matchup game, and Sutter was on the ice, Brent Sutter was on the ice, and Chris Chelios was on the ice. And those are two of the people that you see get excoriated or just ripped apart by Jágr. It was just amazing. And what I remember the most was the energy on our bench. The fan base, obviously, in the old Civic Arena was extremely loud and excited. But after Jágr scored, you just knew we were going to win. It was a matter of time at that point. There's just so much energy on our bench. Their bench was deflated, and our bench was just electrified. It really was.
At that point, Chicago had won 11 straight games. They had a 4-1 lead in that game, and it's the opening game, again, of the Stanley Cup Final.
Yeah.
How much of that huge turnaround in Game 1 do you think believe you guys going on to win the championship?
Well, it was a big part of it because it really broke the spirit of the Blackhawks. And one of the things it did, it kind of exposed Eddie Belfour. And, you know, obviously Eddie's a tremendous goalie and a Hall of Famer. But Eddie had a tough night that night. And again, it started things unraveling behind the scenes. If you remember, I think it was the second goal we scored. Marion scored from below the icing line from the corner. And that kind of got us back in the game. But after game two, I could tell you that we felt really good as a team. We went into one game 3-1-0, a puck that was shot from the point off the back end of Kevin Stevens that went in, and in that game Belfour and Chelios both lost it at the end, so we really had found a way to get after that, those two guys in particular, and that was part of our plan. But yeah, no, that game one was a huge part of it. There's no question about it.
Previous year, Jágr's only a rookie, 3 goals in the playoffs. That year, 92, 24, and 21. Did everybody in the NHL even know how good he was at that point in the finals, Pierre? And what was the difference between year one and year two for Jágr?
Just getting more aware of the league, getting more power play time. He didn't get a lot of power play time in his first year, second year, more power play time. I think the comfort level that he had with Mario just really was oozing. And it's not a knock on these guys, but when we made the big trade to get Rick Tocchet on Chel Samuelson and Kenny Raggett for Paul Coffey and Mark Recchi, it opened up a lot more time for Jaromir because Recchi was a right winger just like Jágr was. And so it opened up more time for him, and everything got slotted a little bit differently. And I think just Jaromir just learned how to shoot the puck a little better. I think a guy that doesn't get enough credit, Sean, is Rick Kehoe, who did such a good job working with Jaromir on his shot, and that was something that really helped Jaromir a lot. He could score from further out, which made a big difference.
I read last week that Jaromir Jágr is still thinking about playing next season over in Czech.
He owns a team in Kladno, so he's the owner, he's the president, he's a general manager, he's a team captain if he wants to be. he's pretty much everything.
But they've
Kladno.
Also, they've been relegated, have they not, Pierre?
I think they actually were this year. I think they have.
Maybe that didn't work out as well as they hoped. Anyway, all right, put a few more bums in the seats for sure. Well, I want to put you in a happy place, Pierre, to start your Tuesday, reliving memories of Game 1 of the year you won the Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
So go twirl your Stanley Cup ring around your finger a few times and enjoy the day, and we'll chat with you again tomorrow.
You're very kind, Jared. Thanks a lot, Sean. Take care. Have a great day, everyone.
Yeah. All